Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are just two numbers you need to know today, everybody. 7.5% and 165,000. It's Jobs Day, baby. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 3rd of May. Great to have you with us. And we are going to begin where the economic day began today. The April unemployment report, 7.5% is the jobless rate. That is down just a tick. 165,000 is the number of new jobs added to the American economy last month. 4 minutes of live radio is what we're going to be spending digesting those numbers and the news of the week. For that, we've got Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Catherine Rampell from the New York Times. They are in our New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so we're happy, right, Catherine? Come on, help me out here.
We're relieved, I would say.
Oh, no, 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 no. Wait a minute. That's so funny, because we were talking before about what you were going to say when I asked you that question, and I said, she's going to be reserved.
Yes. Well, that's sort of my MO, I guess. I try to be reserved when the jobs numbers come out. People like to make a big deal out of them,
yep.
But, you know, it's just one data point. It gets revised. The headline number was, you know, middling. It was fine. It was not nearly what the economy needs to recover a lot of the ground lost during the recession. That's what I mean when I say we're relieved. Mm-hmm. It's not like we had gangbuster growth.
Right.
But, on the other hand, there were a lot of economists out there who were worried that we were going to get a really bad number this month, given that initial reports for last month were also pretty disappointing.
Right.
So, you know, we thought the spring swoon might come back.
Well, yeah. So, Cardiff, you know, along those lines and to Catherine's initial point, do we make too much of this number? And should we only maybe do the jobs number like once every 6 months?
I don't know if we have to, like, resort to that kind of economic indicator nihilism, right? I mean, but
okay.
It's absolutely true that with a report like this, you set the bar low enough and it becomes easy to step over.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, as Catherine noted, there were some really valid concerns that maybe we were headed into the same kind of, like, mid-year swoon, mid-year downturn that we've experienced in the last few years. And the revisions to the prior months in this report, I think, indicated that maybe the severity of that downturn wasn't going to be that bad. But I'll tell you what's really unfortunate about all this is that right now policy is pushing in the wrong direction.
Right. Explain that a little bit. Yeah.
Of course. So essentially earlier this year, payroll taxes went up on everybody. We now have the looming spending cuts from the sequestration issue. And unfortunately, even as a lot of other economic indicators are getting worse or at least are coming in worse than expected, policy isn't doing anything to help. And that leaves basically just the Federal Reserve. But it, too, is somewhat constrained in what it's going to do. So I'm not too optimistic that things are going to rapidly accelerate from here, relieved though I am.
But, Catherine, the Fed said this week in a statement after its meetings, it basically said, listen, we're going to keep on doing what we can. I mean, the Fed is going to help us out, right?
Well, the Fed has been helping us out. It's been helping us out for 5 years.
Years and
now.
Years and years, yeah.
Years and I mean, it feels like millennia at this point that they really started pumping money into the economy. But there's only so much they can do. You know, at some point you get kind of diminishing returns when you've already increased their balance sheet so much. You know, interest rates have been at zero for a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
They can try to help out. But if Congress continues counteracting them by having this fiscal tightening, there's not really that much power that they have left to further goose the economy.
Okay, but hang on a second, the both of you, because you both sort of – well, what I heard was you guys saying we don't have to worry about the spring swoon anymore. But do we maybe, thanks to the Congress of the United States, Cardiff, have to worry about a summertime swoon?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that we don't have to worry about it. I just think that it might not be as bad as we initially expected it to be. So, again, lowering the bar, easy to step over. But, yeah, I'm worried about all of this stuff all the time. If you were looking for a couple of happy guests, you probably chose the wrong two people today. But, yeah, I'm worried about it. And a lot of this stuff also has to do with some other underlying trends in the economy, such as that a lot of the jobs that are replacing the ones that were lost in the downturn now are lower paying service sector
right,
jobs.
Right.
So even the jobs that are coming back aren't doing as much for lower and middle class Americans as we'd hope.
Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alpha Villain, Catherine Rampell from the New York Times. They were in our New York studios. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend, huh?
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
All right, we'll see you. On Wall Street today, Dow 15,000. Anybody? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We had the Case-Shiller Index come out earlier this week. It showed home prices are up, generally speaking, and pretty handily up, too. That's happening in part because Wall Street investors, speculators is another way to say that, have been buying up foreclosed homes by the thousands. And now, get this, they're trying to get regular investors involved. A company called Colony American Homes that's been turning vacant homes into rental properties is going to go public on the stock market. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on the second act of the American housing crash.
You could call it the buy low, rent high philosophy. Companies have been snapping up single-family homes at low prices and renting them out for a healthy profit, says Keith Gumbinger of mortgage information website HSH.com.
It's almost like buying an investment at a discount. So investors have been enjoying themselves with rental real estate over the last couple of years now.
Colony American Homes has scooped up more than 8,000 single-family homes and is renting them out. Private equity giant Blackstone Group bought more than 24,000 homes. Two other companies in the buy and rent market went public last year. Glenn Kelman is the CEO of Redfin, a real estate website.
And the tragedy of it is that right as home prices have become really affordable, credit has not been accessible. And the lending environment has really driven more people into the rental market.
The housing crisis has sent home ownership to an 18-year low. Meanwhile, rents have been rising around 5% a year.
I think it's a great business. I don't know how sustainable it is.
Kelman says that's because investors are having to fight each other to buy homes now.
I think that it's going to be very competitive getting the inventory to rent out, and that's going to be the gate on their growth.
Still, these companies are changing the market, says Susan Wachter, a professor of real estate and finance at Wharton.
They will, in fact, create a new market for single-family rental that is a professional, institutionally-backed market. That's new, and I expect it to persist.
Renters now occupy more than a third of all single-family homes in the U.S. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Two items from the Annals of Washington Lobbying to set up this next story for you. Item one, a report from the Sunlight Foundation that showed in the past 5 years, 3,000 lobbyists have worked on immigration reform. 3,000 different people bending congressional ears on just one issue. Item number two, there is no ear in Washington harder to bend than that of the President of the United States, which led to an item in Politico this week saying that one advocacy group, knowing the president is a big sports fan, bought an ad on ESPN. Marketplace's David Gura explores the price that must be paid to get the attention of the president and his inner circle.
Lobbyists have free rein on Capitol Hill. The House and Senate office buildings are open to the public. Of course, access to the White House is different. Howard Marlowe's been a lobbyist for more than three decades.
We've had direct contact with the president's office probably a half a dozen times, and that's all.
The leader of the free world is a busy man. Andy Rosenberg is with Thorn Run Partners. He says the number of visitors coming into the White House is tightly controlled, and so is information.
The president has to be among the most insulated people on the planet.
So lobbyists have to be strategic. Roan Resch represents the solar energy industry.
It's not that you always have to bend the ear of the president. It's that you have to get in to talk to the person who's going to talk to the president and bend their ear first.
He's talking, of course, about the president's inner circle of advisors. First, you've got to identify those people. A good lobbyist cultivates connections. Resch says he knows where certain aides go to church, what they read.
We found that one of the best ways is really through their kids.
The Solar Energy Industries Association has a little league strategy. The group put up solar-powered scoreboards at baseball fields in Chevy Chase. That's a neighborhood, Resch says, that's home to many White House officials. Lobbyist Paul Equali says gimmicks can be hit or miss.
The best way to get your point of view in front of the president is to be a major donor to his political party.
That's a strategy that's worked for decades, Equali says, and still has the best odds. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The National Rifle Association's annual meeting is this weekend. The NRA says it's going to be one of its biggest meetings ever. More than 70,000 people are expected to show up. Attendance is up at NRA fundraising events as well, which is adding cash to its charitable programs. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer-Kent reports.
Several teens and their parents gather in a red clay field in rural Minden, Louisiana. It's a makeshift skeet shooting range for members of the local 4-H chapter. A lot of the equipment for this program comes from friends of the NRA. Rodney Peterson is the 4-H shotgun instructor. He says these grants encourage a lifetime of safe shooting.
We've been doing this now for 8 or 9 years, never with a mishap. It's all about being safe. One accident can ruin it for everybody.
To generate money for these programs, Friends of the NRA holds about 1,100 banquets nationwide each year. And lately, these banquets have been drawing record crowds. Kurt Green of Texarkana, Texas, goes to a lot of these fundraisers. He says even in a mediocre economy, gun rights supporters are opening up their wallets like never before.
When you attack the Second Amendment, you bring the supporters out. Friends of the NRA is non-political, but probably 80-90% of the people there are members of the NRA. Like myself. And so, you know, this is a way that, you know, they can be political through NRA, but they can support locally through Friends of NRA.
The organization has raised more than $200 million since it started these dinners back in the mid-90s. Green meets with other banquet organizers once a year to divvy up proceeds to area school districts and 4-H teams. He says he wants to fund proposals that reach the most kids.
In this part of the country, it's a tradition. I don't hardly know anybody that own a gun. I don't know, man, done on multiple guns. And we want our kids to have the same thing that we had.
In Louisiana, more than 5,000 kids are enrolled in the 4-H shooting sports program, making it the biggest draw of the organization. Back at skeet practice, 18-year-old Carmen Underwood is a reigning national champion in 28-gauge shooting. She's been competing since she was in fourth grade.
I honestly believe that if I couldn't shoot anymore, I don't know what I would do, because this is one of the only things that I will continue to do until I am old.
When Underwood goes off to college next year, she hopes to start a shooting club and be its volunteer instructor, possibly with the help of an NRA grant. In Minden, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Coming up,
my prized possession actually was my Encyclopedia Britannica, which had all this amazing information. That was sort of my search engine at the time.
Yeah, it's a little bit different now. Ray Kurzweil of Google on the future of search. But first, let's do the numbers. A day of big round numbers and new highs on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials briefly crossed the 15,000 mark for the first time, settled back to close at 14,973. Still, gain of 142.9%. The S&P 500 went busting through 1,600 and stayed there, finished at 1,614, jump of 16 points or 1%. The NASDAQ stepped up 38 points, 1.1%, ended things at 3,378. For the week gone by, the Dow gained 1.8%, the S&P 500 up 2%, the NASDAQ beat them all, added 3%. Today, as we discussed earlier, the jobs report sent the bulls running. Caterpillar shares scooped up 3.25% today. Price of oil rose today. Energy stocks followed. ExxonMobil climbed 1.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The annual GI Film Festival gets underway in Washington. It's a week of films and events celebrating the armed forces. On March 6, 1937, the German passenger airship Hindenburg caught fire and was destroyed while landing at Lakehurst, New Jersey, following a transatlantic flight. And some people celebrate International No Diet Day. I will be one of them. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are tens of thousands of people who've moved out to North Dakota for the jobs in the oil fields out there. It's almost all men, too. Almost. that is. Independent radio producer Todd Melby has been working on a series called Black Gold Boom, portraits of people caught up in that oil rush. Today, what it's like to be a young woman surrounded by lonely men who are really far from home.
My name is Nathena St. Pierre. I live here in Watford City. It's a scary place out here for women. And when girls come out here now, they think it's flattering like I did when I first got out here. And I very quickly reassure them that it's not, and they need to be very careful because these guys will, they'll take advantage of you. 6'10". One of my sisters was out here with me the first 6 months I was here, and she was pregnant and waitressing to just make money because the money is so good. And one of the guys was like, hey, honey, I'm going to take you home. You know, I'm going to treat you like a real woman should be treated. And she's like, I'm pregnant and I'm married. He goes, your husband doesn't have to know, and the damage is already done. They're like packs of wolves. They do. They come and they circle around you and try and buy you drinks and, you know, follow you out of the grocery store. You know, it's ridiculous. I carry a .22 pistol. I have an 8-inch blade and a taser and pepper spray. I don't leave home without one of the few, if not all of them, ever. You know, I met a guy out here. I thought he was great, and he was pipeline welding. Everybody said, watch out for pipeliners, watch out for welders. You know, they're the dogs. They'll pick up and leave, and they don't care, and they do. And that's what he did. Didn't matter that he was, you know, telling me one minute he loves me, and then the next minute he's gone, and I haven't heard from him since.
Ben Garvin reported that piece. Todd Melby produced it. Black Gold Boom is an initiative of Local Ore and the Association of Independents in Radio. There was a survey out not too long ago about the prom and about how much kids and their families spend on it. Fancy dresses, tuxedos, stretch Hummers, corsages, it adds up, and there is good reason to talk about the big cost of the big party. But depending on the circumstances, there can be a pretty good educational argument for prom as well. Our education correspondent Amy Scott has the latest in her series about Euler School in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Derek Wilson has decided he wants to go to prom. Only problem, it starts in about 6 hours, and he has nothing to wear. As soon as school's out, staffer Jamie Lugan drives Derek and his date, Passion, to Sears. On the way, they order their $20 tickets.
Just tell her that we need 3 prom tickets.
All right.
I will pay for them either tonight or when I get back.
When they get to the store, they make a beeline for the men's section. Derek spots a purple dress shirt.
Oh, me and Passion should wear this color. Look.
Lugan finds a pair of brown slacks on sale.
Ah, perfect. Yes. Okay, I'm going to try those on.
Those actually are on sale.
Lugan is the resource coordinator at Euler. Most of the kids come from low-income families. She's in charge of wrangling pretty much anything they need. Food, health care, size 17 dress shirt.
When I started there, Derek was, I think, 7th and 8th grader. So I've watched him grow. You want to do the same thing for them that you do for your own kids.
16-year-old Passion steps out of the dressing room with a beige and white strapless dress, revealing a pregnant belly. She and Derek are good friends, and to match her dress, he trades in the purple shirt for a cream-colored one with a brown tie. Lugan covers the $150 for the whole ensemble. They'll work it off, helping her with the after-school program.
So I think you guys will look great together. Yeah, are you happy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right.
Euler hasn't been doing prom all that long. What had been a K-8 school added the upper grade 7 years ago to try to stop a dropout epidemic in the neighborhood. Building a culture of graduates meant adding all the trappings of high school. The first prom was in the gym with a borrowed boombox. Principal Craig Hockenberry says the students asked for a prom.
They asked for it, but I don't think they knew exactly what it was. They just heard other high schools had it. Because you got to remember that many of our kids' parents never went to high school and their grandparents never went to high school. So prom wasn't really part of their vocabulary.
Now they've got it down. The school shuttles the girls to a local charity that outfits them with gowns, shoes, and jewelry. The event is in a banquet hall with a dance floor and buffet. As the couples arrive, they get the red carpet treatment. Assistant Principal Amy Woods.
It's like they've been transformed into this environment of, you know, you're just like everybody else.
And inside, it's just like any prom. A couple makes out in a corner, someone tries to sneak in a flask, and there's line dance after line dance. You'd never guess Derek Wilson, living it up in his brand new shirt and pants, almost didn't come.
I'm really not a party person, but I'm really having a lot of fun here today.
Derek got kicked out of Euler in ninth grade for behavior problems. Hockenberry and the basketball coach talked him into coming back. Next year, he's going to the University of Cincinnati Claremont on a full basketball scholarship.
Oh, man, it feels so good. I graduated on my birthday, so there's nothing more I could want on that day just to graduate and be able to get my diploma.
As the dance winds down, Hockenberry takes the stage. With graduation in a few weeks, he knows he doesn't have much longer to watch over these kids.
I want to remind you all about being safe when you leave here tonight, all right? Make sure you make the right decisions, and I will be at the after party. I heard where it is. I will be there.
In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Shares of Google closed at $845.72 apiece in New York today, up almost 2%. It's been a pretty big week for the company. Google Now launched this week. It's a voice-activated search thing, kind of like Siri. Google Glass, their wearable gizmo, has been getting a whole lot of press. And pretty much everything Google's doing is changing the way we think about and get our information. But what's all that searching doing to us? Futurist Ray Kurzweil was hired not too long ago as the director of engineering at Google. Ms. Kurzweil, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So when you were a kid and you wanted to look for something, how'd you do it?
Well, my prized possession actually was my Encyclopedia Britannica, which had all this amazing information. That was sort of my search engine at the time, or I might actually go to the library.
And where are we right now? I mean, if you wanted to describe the frontier of the search mechanisms that we have today, how would you do it?
It's pretty remarkable the kind of precise information you can have at your fingertips. And, you know, a kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. So it is a different world in terms of finding information.
Make a value judgment for me. Is that better? Necessarily?
People say, well, maybe it's making us stupider because we rely on these machines, but yes, it's definitely better. I mean, these are brain extenders. I think we're going to ultimately move beyond these little devices that are like looking at the world through a keyhole. Ultimately, these devices will be able to put information anywhere in your visual field of view, and you'll be online all the time. Google Glass is a solid first step.
My guess is that you're not all that concerned with the day-to-day profitability of Google, but I wonder how much the folks on campus think about monetizing the future when they work on things that you're interested in.
I think there's a general belief that if you can actually bring value to people, there's usually a way of developing a business model. For example, the ads that Google delivers, the goal is to be a win-win where these ads are not annoying. Like if I see a television commercial for baby diapers, I'm annoyed by it because I stopped buying baby diapers 30 years ago. But if I get an ad for something I really care about, some new supplement, let's say, then I actually appreciate the ad because it's something I'm interested in.
You know, you mentioned Google Glass, this new thing that Google has come out with, which certainly looks to be amazing. It's not widespread yet. But I wonder how far we are from Google Glass and everything being within our field of view that we could need, and honestly, just a chip in the brain that we just think and something happens.
I think these devices will go inside our brain in the 2030s because an exponential trend I talk about is how technology is shrinking. But ultimately, these devices will be the size of blood cells and we'll be able to send them inside our brain through the capillaries and basically connect our brain to the cloud. But that's a mid-2030s scenario.
You know, this idea, though, that you can back everything up in the cloud, you can back up your memories and your, you know, all of that stuff. Can you really back up a personality like that?
Your personality, your skills are contained in information structures in your neocortex, and it is information. So, you know, we can create an avatar today that has a certain personality. It's based on software. It's not yet at human levels.
These technologies will be a million times more powerful in 20 years, and we really will be able to begin to manipulate the information inside your brain.
This does all seem, and I get that you've been doing this for a long time now, but it does all seem really bloodless.
Well, on the contrary, when I say the computers will reach human levels of understanding, you know, by the 2030s, I'm specifically talking about emotion. I'm talking about, you know, getting the joke and being funny and being sexy and being loving. That's the cutting edge of human intelligence. When computers can achieve these things, it's not for the purpose of displacing us. It's really to make ourselves smarter, and smarter in the sense of being more loving and being funnier and so on, really enhancing the things that we value about humans.
Mr. Kurzweil, thanks very much for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a date which, with apologies to Franklin Roosevelt, has already lived in infamy. May the 3rd, 1978, a guy named Gary Turk, he was the marketing manager at Digital Equipment Company, sent what is widely recognized as the first spam email ever. It was a message trying to sell computers, as it happened. Only went to about 330 people who were on ARPANET, which eventually became the internet. But still, from a single seed, as it were, came all of our clogged mailboxes. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, summer travel tips that could save you money and maybe a little bit of sanity, too.
I don't want to be in the car anymore. I want to go home.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad.
This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. And this is APM.